We're not late. You guys are late. Don't worry about that. 9:35 is a perfect time to start, everyone. I'm Tech Summer. That's Paul Wadlington. This is IT Live, and it's brought to you by Academy Sports and Outdoors. And I got some advice for you guys. You should sign up to InsideTexas.com. It's only $1 until the Ohio State game, August 30th, for new members, best recruiting news. We have Tyler Atkinson announcing on Pat McAfee's show here in a couple hours. Hopefully Texas can win that one, but we're also after some flips. We're after elite running back Derek Cooper. So if you're into recruiting, I know we've taken some licks, but hang in there, guys. It's going to still be an interesting remainder of the cycle. And, of course, fall camp's coming up, guys. So that means Eric and Justin are going to be getting all their fall camp notes. You don't want to miss. We have the best team news. You're going to love it. All right. $1 until 8:30. Join InsideTexas.com today. And the guy sitting next to me, Paul, dropped his 2025 Longhorn football prospectus, thinking Texas football. 13 years Paul has put himself through this, having to, you guys remember college or high school, having to write a paper the night before. Imagine having to write 30 papers in like a month. That is not a fun exercise, but Paul does it with grace, wit, and his unique takes on everything that gives you insight that you wouldn't get elsewhere. So buy Thinking Texas Football today. The links are in the description. You can get your ebook. If you're a physical copy guy, more of a gentleman, you can also get that as well. So link in the description, guys. We're also going to do a little bit of a preview here today for the run game, talking about his book.
Physical copy guy.
Yeah. There's the back, guys.
Michael Taft, exultant after Texas OU. This guy's in the front. I was going to put Connor Stroh on the cover.
Interesting.
And I ran it by you, and you're like, hey, man, in my opinion, Arch Manning is more marketable.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, is that true? Is that?
Yeah.
Is that Paul doesn't
have a big feel for the markets, you know?
I mean, Connor's pretty sophisticated from a marketing perspective. I was like, well, Connor Stroh conveys a certain, like, everyman quality. Yeah. Everyone's going to relate to. And you're like, actually, Arch Manning's a pretty big deal, I think.
Well, and also, man, the red hair would pop more.
Pop with Will Gallagher's beautiful photos. But you were like, I was like, the backup quarterback, the scrub.
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah, believe it or not.
Well, funny enough, we do have somebody that basically called Arch a scrub from SEC Media Days that we will talk about towards the end of the show. We've kind of got a bunch of hot takes. You know how SEC Media Days is. If SEC wants you to pay attention, that means ESPN's going to say some wild stuff, and you're going to be like, oh, yeah, everything's going on at Media Days. Eric did announce yesterday Paul will be doing an audiobook version, and it will be voiced by Lou Ferrigno.
Yes, the great part of it will be Lou Ferrigno, the opponent preview portion, which I preview every Texas opponent, and then the entire SEC, even the teams we don't play. That's going to be Harvey Fierstein.
Wow, dude. Wow. These are some deep cuts, dude.
Yeah, very good voice.
All right. How hard it would be to get Arch to sign it? Incredibly hard. Turns out it's probably tough to get to Arch Manning. I wonder what new words Paul will use today. Paul's not – Eric is the one that will just – he has his word in the article, and he'll drop it, and then you'll hear it that next week, you know. Eric's adding to the repertoire. Paul says, wow, I've had to look up words Paul says in his articles, so.
He'll fixate on, like, the word truculent.
Yeah, exactly.
Use it for a week every day.
Yeah. That's how he reps it in.
I think he has a word calendar. It's your new day, and he's like, this is your word. It defines it, tells you if it's an adverb.
Yeah, and Paul will do it. But it's already naturally integrated with Paul. Okay, we're going to talk the run game. We're going to use the preview as the backdrop here. We want to talk about the running back room, also what Arch brings to the run game, as well as our newer offensive line. What I'll be able to do is, everybody who was on yesterday's show, we had the depth charts pulled up, our official IT depth charts. We'll pull that up just so we can talk through players on it here in a second. But
do that.
Let's see. It'll be easier this way. Okay, cool.
Have you seen this knockoff AI book that's on Amazon? Purports to be my biography. Have you seen this?
No.
Yeah. If you do a search on Amazon for, you know, 2025 Thinking Texas Football, or my name, Paul Wadlington, you'll come up with Thinking Texas Football 2025, the untold story of Paul Wadlington. Wow. How a devoted Longhorn fan turned passion into the ultimate 2025 college football preview.
That's awesome, dude. You got like a behind the scenes of your own book that's completely made up, which would be funny.
Well, and that has a biography of me where I grew up in Houston.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's all fake. It's all AI generated. And what they do is they basically, they'll take books that are tracking on the charts. Really right, well,
exactly.
And they'll just knock out this thing in like 20 minutes and try to lure unsuspecting buyers into buying. Oh, I want to learn about Paul.
Yeah.
Ridiculous. Yeah, yeah, I have lore. That's the crazy thing. It's all fake though.
that's even cooler though, dude.
Yes, the author's name, the fake name is Jimmy Wolf. I think he lives in Calcutta, by the way.
That's honestly awesome, dude. I wouldn't even be mad if they're stealing clicks. I'd say this is
well, fun. I am mad insofar as I think people may have bought it.
Right, exactly.
Like, this is cool. And it's
also how much of a narcissist would you have to be to write yourself a life biography as the guy that writes a Texas football game? Review?
Dude, I did. I do a fake insane. Name of like, oh, this guy Jimmy Wolf keeps writing about me. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, or you should flip it on its head and be like, Jimmy Wolf is one of the best biographers this world has seen.
That's right.
But yeah, that's weird and it's funny though. All right,
it is.
Running back room, using your preview. Let me get back to your running back section, dude.
Did you do this?
No, Will did. Will, our graphic designer. Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it wouldn't look this good. There's no shot.
That's why.
Yeah, that's the difference. You always love my graphics, so I'm sure you could tell. That's why you're like, this can't be yours. This isn't you. All right. Oh, yeah, there we go, Justin Wells. Flip it on its head. Write a Jimmy Wolf bio. See how long this can go.
I'm going to do that.
All right, running back room. Let's start with our dear leader, Trey Wisner, the man that Clemson and A&M fear, a guy on a bicycle on the sideline, giving it everything he's got, all the intangibles here. What else do you think about him, Paul?
I just had an image when you said on the bicycle. Obviously, they get on the stationary bike to stay loose, but what if they had like a tricycle with the flowy things on the handlebars? What are those called? Streamers?
Streamers.
Yeah, and you make the guy ride a tricycle up and down the sideline to stay
psychological warm. Warfare. This guy's running for 200 on you, and he's riding a tricycle.
Well, it could be like the tricycle from the torture movies, the Saw movies. You know how he rides that big oversized tricycle. Anyway, my imagination's too active this morning. Man, Cole Hudson looks like a nice kid. He doesn't act that way on the field, does he?
No, he's from that running offense in Frisco too.
He's got the Joe Cook rosy cheeks.
Yep. Joe said, we're about to drop like 15 videos today because like Sark's talking, all the players are talking. So SEC media days,
baby.
Yeah, Joe Cook's on site, guys. We're going to have a bunch of videos today, all of the players talking and stuff. So be on the lookout for that.
All right, you asked me about Wisner. So obviously we all love Wisner because he stepped in. Jaden Blue wasn't Mr. Consistency. Christian Clark tears his Achilles. CJ Baxter shreds his knee. What are we going to do? Hey, we look to our fourth string running back who had been a special teams maniac and demon the year prior. And he comes in and just basically puts the burden of the room on his shoulders and carries us. We tried to split that burden with Jarek Gibson, but Mr. Gibson dropped the ball three times in his limited carries. And so we said, we're going to try to go Trey here.
Yeah.
He was listed last year at 200. I think he was barely 190. But he shouldered the burden for good and for bad for our running game. I think everyone should appreciate him. But one of the things that I do point out in my preview is he's one of the more least efficient lead backs we've had in some time at Texas. And I mean that from not only a running standpoint, but a pass catching standpoint. I think he averaged 6.5 yards a reception, and he actually had a pretty large number of targets that were not completed. And those should be pretty easy completions, right? So from an efficiency standpoint, that wasn't great. And then running the ball, it was sort of hit or miss. As the season wore on, I think he wore down a little bit. But also, if you really look at it pretty critically, his biggest runs were really perfectly blocked. Like his job was to complete the run, you know?
Right.
And you didn't see a ton of extra yards, particularly late in the season when he's running into Ohio State, Arizona State. They really struggled. We really struggled running the ball against Clemson. Obviously, he and Jaden Blue both went off, but that was a function more of Clemson and some of their inherent schematic issues. And also our offensive line just pushed him around. So, not trying to take anything away from him, but we do need to, if we're going to maximize as a football team and actually maximize Wisner, we've got to distribute his load. He's got to be a 10 to 15 touch per game guy.
Yeah. And so just raw numbers, taking the emotion out of it, because we know how much he's a fan favorite and he deserves that. He's 21st out of 29 SEC players in yards per attempt.
That's right.
So yards per attempt is low. And then let's look at yards after contact per attempt. He's middle of the pack, 18th out of 29 in yards after contact per attempt.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you had a Rojo or a Bijan high up there in yards per attempt, ideally your back is, you know, top five there when you're trying to maximize. So there's just some realities to the numbers here. You're able to do a lot. So, for instance, Trey Wisner is, and he was fourth in the SEC in attempts, right? So yeah. we hear, oh, he's a 1,000-yard back. He's a 1,000-yard back. Sure, but he also had a ton of bites at the apple there.
Yeah, a little snippet from my Thinking Texas football preview.
Well, actually, I got that wrong. He had 226 attempts, second in the SEC.
That's right.
This is even higher.
He averaged 4.7 yards per carry. That's the lowest yards per carry average of a Longhorn lead back since 2017, which was Daniel Young. And if you remember that 2017 offense, it was not great.
Yeah, and if you notice, all three top backs that had the most attempts, all three of them were 1,000-yard rushers. And oddly, number one was Sampson. He had 258 attempts. He got 1,400 yards. Wisner at 226 had 1,060. And then Jarquez Hunter at Auburn had 186, so 40 less than Wisner, and he had 1,200 yards. So 40 less attempts, 200 more yards. So we have to quit thinking of things as if you're a 1,000-yard rusher, you're automatic. That means automatically good. Not necessarily. The volume really matters there. And if Sark's system has produced a 1,000-yard rusher every single year, we should question, this seems more like a systematic feature than necessarily the back. So we have to think of it that way. So here's the deal with Wisner. Awesome team leader. Maximize him by getting less. But if you're really trying to maximize the offense, the best option, you want more NFL traits or even more efficiency just as a college back. So that's a big factor. And of course, we'll talk about offensive line too. It's not all Trey here. But that's kind of thing with Trey. We know it's controversial. We know everybody likes him. We have to give you our analysis on him. Still love him as a player. He's still going to do great things for us, right?
Yep.
Cool. All right. Now let's talk about CJ Baxter. Injured all last year. First year, little questionable. I had some problems with Baxter staying up too. It felt like anytime Baxter got touched early in his first year, he kind of went down, and which was weird for his size. And then later on in the season, we saw better things from Baxter, and then, of course, he gets hurt. He has the NFL measurables there, right? He's a big back, powerful, tall, all of that kind of stuff. So he has more of the traditional build.
Yeah, when you're a high school running back and you're over 6 feet tall, you don't get punished for running high. You are able to run high and sort of upright, and you can see better, and you can cut better, right? And you don't get punished for running like that, because you can still run through people. You get to the college level, you got to learn to lower your pads. If you guys remember, even Ricky Williams, who was very compact and obviously very strong, he would get lit up quite a bit as a true freshman. I don't know if people remember that, but he learned to get his pads down. He learned to get his level down, and he became a running back you did not want to run up and meet in the A-gap at all. But yeah, I think you're going to see a similar transition with CJ Baxter. He's just been hurt. You know, he's had 2 years really hampered by injuries. And it's not just been, you know, injuries are part of the game in football. Hey, you know, the guy blew out his knee. That happens to running backs. He's had a series of injuries, particularly as a freshman. He didn't really have the armor, right, built up in the weight room. So he had like a series of maladies there. And then he blew out his knee. So we haven't really seen what CJ Baxter might be. We're hoping it's something awesome, but he certainly made good use of his offseason time and his recovery time. He got up over 230 pounds, and that's what we wanted to see.
And same thing, leadership, right? He was able to be a leader on the team while hurt, which is hard. We're really lucky. We've had a real string of leaders at the running back position. That's not necessarily a position of leadership on most teams. Running backs can kind of just be bulldogs, you know? But we've been really lucky with Trey and CJ, of course, Bijan. We just had Rojo is who I think of as the perfect leader. We've been really lucky at that position to have guys that are really taking accountability at that position and being active too. All right, number three, I think it's the running back that me and you are most excited for just watching his tape, Christian Clark. Really fun run style and moves like Bijan. What I mean by that is forward motion with lateral ability at the same time. I always say it's like an alpine skier. When you watch those guys going between trees, they're moving forward, but they're moving side to side well. It looks like they're kind of gliding. And Christian Clark has that. We do think it was a partial tear. Paul said that because he came back quick. And then we had some type of doctor or physical therapist comment on that video and say, hey, I think it's a partial tear too due to his recovery timeline. But he looks back and we're excited for him. I think he has the most total ability running the ball. I don't know about pass blocking. I don't know about that. But as far as zone running ability, I like him a lot.
The real takeaway here is basically I'm a physician.
Yes. Yeah.
That got confirmed.
He doesn't just play it on YouTube. Real thing. Yeah.
That's right. She called me doctor for the rest of this segment. Yeah. But yeah, Christian Clark, we're excited to see him. We haven't seen him, right? I mean, we really need to kind of see him on the field doing it in live action.
And in college.
Yeah. And he's kind of a transitional back, right? He's about 210, 6 feet tall. He has that side to side jump cut lateral agility. But we need to see, hey, can he hang on to the football? Does he run hard? Does he have power? What's his speed? You know, how has his injury affected that side to side? You know, because that's really what the Achilles is really bad about, is it really takes away that sort of flexibility and bounciness. But that was one of the things they were calling out recently in 7-on-7s, that he's moving really well. So we're going to have to see. But the more he shows, the more likely we have a real running back by committee.
For sure. Then we have Jared Gibson. So pre-spring and going into spring, he was circled, meaning that sources were trying to get him ready. They thought maybe that was RB1, right?
Yeah.
And then we didn't see that come to fruition, which is, you know, not your favorite sign, but doesn't mean it's the end of the world. The issues with Gibson were fumbling, like Paul said, and just understanding of pass blocking, understanding protections he had issues with. But I did like his ability to get forward. He was able to do that. And he's one of those guys, if he gets contacted, he's still getting 5 yards. Yeah. And, man, that matters. So Gibson's interesting here at the 4 spot because he's the most intriguing back to me if he figures it out, because he does have that size and situational ability. And, of course, sources liked him, right? So why do they like him? They're seeing something, you know? So that's going to be the tricky part with Gibson. Just make sure all the other parts of being a running back and holding on to the ball stay up. But this room was, I mean, I wanted to transfer, you know, Ahmad Hardy preferably, right? Can you know what I'm talking about? ULM, he's a baller. But, and I think we all did, but as CJ Baxter got healthy on the timeline, Clark, now I feel better about this room. This room's more just interesting to me now. Who's going to pop? I still think Wisner is going to be your leader and your one that's going to give you the juice. What can Baxter do coming back from injury? Is Christian Clark going to surprise? Is Gibson going to take that jump? There's a lot of narrative in this one room right now.
Yeah, and we're going to be transitioning more to gap schemes. Last year, we were 52% zone, 48% gap. So yeah. I've heard people sort of being like, oh, we were zone all last year. We were zone only last year. It's like, not really.
But it felt like that because wide zone would get, when it didn't work, wide zone just felt like it was all we were running and getting shut down, you know. But
and when it worked, it looked like Clemson.
When it worked, it looked like Clemson. It looked like A&M. Yeah. So,
yeah, I think that's going to be the interesting thing, is how you marry abilities not only to the game plan, but also the flow of that game. So Wisner makes sense as the guy you're going to see every week. Mm-hmm. I kind of wonder who they're going to fill in around him and if that's going to vary week to week, depending on game plan, opponent, how someone just looks. Like sometimes you put in a dude to spell someone for two carries and he just runs the ball awesome. So it's like, I'm not taking him out. Like, keep handing it to him. So Jarek Gibson, I think that's going to be his chance to shine. Also, he was kind of our short yardage back, right, de facto. And Everyone loves it when a play's blocked perfectly and someone can house it. Very valuable to have a running back that you don't block it well. Someone meets him in the gap. It should be second and 10, but he makes it become second and 7. And that doesn't sound really glamorous, but, man, it really helps keep your offense ahead of the chains. And so that's Jarek Gibson. Obviously, he has to hold on to the football. The pass blocking stuff isn't – so when you have pass blocking issues for a running back, it's either one of two things. They don't really understand what they're being asked to do, or they're not physical. Like, they're shying from the contact. Jarek Gibson's not shying from contact. That's not the issue. He's never really been asked to pass block.
Yeah.
So he'll be fine in that regard. He's going to grow. The main thing is he's got to hold on to the ball. And especially if you want to define yourself as the finisher, as the short yardage back, as the guy that, you know, you've got a lead and you want to put it on someone's shoulders in the fourth quarter to just grind it out and grind the chains. Fumbler is not the word that goes with that profile.
For sure.
Right. So no running back can fumble. You know, no coach likes that. But especially if you want to be the short yardage back and the closer, the word fumbler can't be associated with you.
Yeah, for sure.
Connor didn't listen to any of that.
Well, I just, when you talk, dude, I'm just like, ugh. You know?
Connor's got a game up.
That would be funny. What's Paul Feinbaum saying about Arch right now?
He's playing Missile Command.
Yeah.
He's like, cool. Anyway.
Yeah. Whenever you just Charlie Brown when you talk, and I never reference anything you say.
He's just waiting for the pause.
Yeah. Oh, thank God he's done talking. All right. I want to see what David Keith Williams saying here. Sorry, I think he started up here. I think Longhorn Nation respects Trey Wisner. I don't think that respect is at the level it should be, regardless of the amount of games in a season. Wisner missed one game and parts of two others. While missing those games, he still became the first Texas Longhorns running back to rush for 1,000-plus and catch 40-plus passes in the same season.
Yep, that's a description of volume. That's the point that we're kind of making. If you catch 40 balls, but you average 5.5 or 6.5 yards per catch, what really happened there?
Right. So our argument is an efficiency argument. You can see that in kind of spready offenses. Guys will do that often. The difference is whenever you do get the ball, what's your efficiency? What's your yards per run? What's your yards per catch? Those kind of things. And so that's the trick. And it's going back to like the 1,000-yard rusher doesn't mean much to me. It's great we have it, but Sark does it every year regardless of who the back is. The back could be someone at a Najee Harris level NFL profile, could be at Trey Wisner's NFL profile, which is not an early rounder. That's more of a system thing. It's great. You still got to do it. So we're not taking that away, but it does end up being more about Sark's scheme than the individual running back, because we've seen that so varied across his teams. Okay.
I think we got a super chat.
Do we?
We do.
Here we go. We got to start. Yep.
Get off Missile Command. You might notice the super chats.
In relation to how hard is it to pick up Sark's offense as a running back in relation to wide receiver? So it's like wide receiver, he's really hard on him. It's very pro style. How hard is it to learn the running back position?
I think running back's easier. I mean, you've got to learn the things. Now, I will say, if you haven't done zone in high school, if you were just, hey, let's line up, run the ball downhill. But even in high school level, most the zone schemes have trickled down. So
yeah,
that used to be a big adjustment for guys of like one cut and go. Like, you can't do this like dancing around on the, you know, in the field, or try to, you know, a lot of high school backs try to bounce everything outside.
Yeah,
because they get young backs in general, right? Yeah. In college, you learn quickly you can't bounce everything outside. There's fast guys that'll run you down, and the edges will actually contain, right? They just won't run upfield.
So here's the thing for fans on your zone read, right? A zone read means that the offensive linemen are blocking an area, not a man. So they're going to work combo blocks. They're going to work on one defensive line and level, and then they're going to climb to a linebacker. with that system, because the defensive line can move at any point, you're going off a concept, not a rule on where someone's going to be. Yeah. It changes the blocks every down. So you have to read better at zone, because things are, the picture's going to change for you all the time, meaning that you're going to have to look, am I going C gap? No. B gap? No. A gap? Cut back. So there, you're reading much more across the line in your zone schemes. In a gap scheme where an offensive lineman is pulling with a tight end and counter, for instance, you know what gap you're going to. You're following your blockers. It's less thought process than a zone read. So that's why younger backs, even in college, when they don't have experience with the system, can struggle more with zone reading. And so when you hear a running back has great vision, that's normally related to their ability in the zone game, because you need to be able to see the field a lot more in zone.
Yep, that's right. And you know, even when we run outside zone, the hole could open up over the center, or it could basically turn into a sweep.
Yep.
So you just have to be willing and not commit to this idea of like, I'm running here. You have to go where the hole presents itself and where the defenders basically remove themselves, right?
And you have to be patient, because the block's not always there immediately. You have to be able to sit and kind of wait. And backs, young backs hate that. They just run straight up into the line.
Yeah, and the other thing, so for running backs, pass blocking is usually something new for them. The rules for it are not hard as a running back.
Yeah, inside out. Yeah, inside
that's
out.
That's it. But yeah, it, you have to get used to it. You have to also block. Like, dudes who are bell cows in high school, they're not blocking. They're the ones carrying the ball. So they have to get used to that. You know, the idea of how to square up on a linebacker and pop them. You know, you've got to meet them. You can't wait for them or you're going to lose the battle. And then also, there's some stuff in the passing game. They have to learn some things. Like, how does it compare to wide receiver? I would say wide receiver has tougher uptake, because you're going to be seeing different zones. You're going to be seeing different coverages. They're going to show cloud and then switch to man or vice versa. And as a young wide receiver, often you're just running routes in high school.
Correct.
You just run the post irrespective of the coverage.
And you're D1, so you're faster than the safety. You know, it's like, so yeah, that's the difference. Running back, you're going to do a lot of flare screen. You're going to be in the screen game, so that's a little bit different. And Sark does some fun stuff in the screen game. Yep. But yeah, wide receiver, I would also say, is tougher. And running back, when we mean you're reading outside in, you're looking at you're normally responsible for a running back, maybe a nickel safety over here. One, you got to scan 1 to 2. If the linebacker, middle linebacker doesn't fire, you need to get your eyes on the nickel who could potentially come or the safety who could potentially come. But our running backs particularly were struggling with stunts. So they weren't reading stunts well. And maybe we should teach it better, I guess. But, you know, a defensive end would stunt inside into the B gap from the C to the B. And then they would mug the linebacker to threaten the running back, thinking that's his guy. They would stunt the end from C to B. And what that does is going to pry open the C gap for a nickel blitz. And we struggled with that nickel blitz due to that. And teams figured that out. Kirby Smart, like, once they realized our running backs were struggling with all that information, we saw it pretty often. It was not ideal. There's some spots on tape. So we'll have to see if that gets fixed. what's a pin and pull? So you're going to want to down block, say like your tight ends here. You're going to have some type of end. Either he can block down and you can pull a tackle, guard, whatever out in front. It'll look like a sweep. But really what you're trying to do with a pin and pull is you're trying to pin guys inside and then pull guys from the offensive line that have better leverage. And it's normally a front side play versus power and counter are going to pull a backside guard. Whenever you see these sweeps, kind of pin and pull stuff, they're going to generally pull a front side player.
Yep, that's classic gap blocking. So when we say we're going to transition more to gap blocking this year, I kind of talk about this in my preview. And what they mean specifically is we're going to run more counters. We're going to run more pin and pulls. Probably not as many like halfback lead ISO type things, because we don't quite have our personnel ready for that yet. But that's one of the reasons we brought on Emery Winston, is we want to be able to run that kind of stuff. And when he gets a little more mature, he's going to be the lead blocking fullback effectively. He'll be an H-back leading on some of that classic inside gap stuff. But counter gaps, counter tray, sometimes they call it GT counter. It's all the mm-hmm. same play. That's going to be something we really do a lot along with that pin and pull.
Yeah, and that's why we want our tight ends to be able to block, because they're going to have to pull up to linebackers often. You see a lot of their movement. Does backside mean weak side? Not necessarily, yes. But backside can always just mean the opposite way of where the play is going. So you have the play side where the running back's running, and then the backside is just whatever guard is not going.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah. So I was thinking, I was thinking of it in a different sense. You were talking about the strength, like the declaration of strength of the offense. Yeah, you're right. It doesn't necessarily mean that. But backside means literally where the play was not intended to go.
Yeah.
Weak side can often be the backside.
Yeah, usually is.
But not necessarily.
I have to hit you with the well technically just so I don't teach you something wrong. No,
you
got me. Yeah.
You're right. You're exactly right. I was thinking of it a little differently. Formation. Like, I wasn't thinking of the formational strength as being weak side. Because backs will use weak side and backside interchangeably, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas a tight end or an offensive lineman will not do that. Strong side means something to them. Very definitive.
So, like, Shanahan's really good about this. They run a ton of weak side stuff. So they're always trying to run to the bubble and a four down. And to make that simple, you're going to have a one technique and a three technique. They're going to try to run to where next to the nose, who's a one technique, to an open three technique. It's an open B gap, and it's known as the bubble in the run game. So if they do an overfront, I know this is a little in the weeds, I just want to teach you. If they do an overfront where the three technique, say, is hanging out in between the right guard and the right tackle for Texas here, you're going to have an open B gap on the backside. That's the bubble. So you could put your strength, meaning your running strength, meaning your tight end, to that side. And then Shanahan will always just call a weak side run. They're just trying to always target that bubble in the offensive line, usually a B gap. And so that's where you can get a lot of weak side runs. If the team is running an over front. So you see it all the time in Shanahan. Sometimes too, you guys will notice how everything stays the same and Sark will just flip the back. He'll just move the back to the other side. Yeah. That's because they lined up the wrong way for the bubble there. And they're just making it to where the running back can now hit the weak side.
If you've ever wondered, so when you're watching a game and you're on a far hash and we run outside to the short hash, in other words, the short side of the field, people are like, why are we doing that? That's so stupid. We're playing games with some of the slants and stuff that defenses do. And often you'll even create the weak side. Like, you won't have the tight end on the short side you're running to. You'll do it on the other side. Yep. And you have this double lure of you want everyone to slant hard towards the wide side of the field, towards the tight end. And then you run the back on the short side.
Yeah.
And when it doesn't work, everyone goes nuts and is like, this is so stupid.
Yeah,
but what they're trying to basically catch the defense doing that, and when it does work, that thing clears out, and you'll see just green. So,
sometimes it's not going to work, but the other coordinator, who's the other chess player, you're like, hey, I'm going to threaten the weak side. You can't just cheat all game thinking I'm going to run strong side. So I might not. I'm investing here. I'm just letting you know you can't cheat me. You have to protect your weak side. You know?
It's a gotcha run. It's not intended to gain 4 yards. Yeah. It's intended to score, or it'll be 2nd and 11.
Yeah, so. Exactly. And that's a lot of times, like, I remember when I would watch stuff, I'm like, this was so stupid. Why did they do that? If you start changing, like, hey, maybe they're – think, what if I was investing for a play later or investing to try to incentivize a coordinator to do something I want them to do? Think of it like that way versus your gut instinct would be like, this guy doesn't know what he's doing. Sark generally knows what he's doing.
Shows certain things purposely early, mm-hmm. comes back to it late, and then does the twist. And these are these one-shot kill plays, often throwing the ball, where the quarterback has got to hit the open guy deep.
That was the brutal part about it.
That's the whole point of the setup, right? And that's one of the ways in which Arch Manning is going to help level us up a little bit.
That was a really frustrating part with Quinn, because Sark would invest for 3 quarters to then go to the 2nd or 3rd layer of a play, and we would just miss it. And that's a brutal aspect. And what we mean by layering your plays, this is the simplest example. People will get it. I talked about it yesterday. Xavier Worthy on a lead block, right, on a wide receiver screen. You're like, what are we doing? Xavier Worthy cannot block. The play gets blown up. Okay, we do that 2-3 more times. Now the defense thinks that they know that play, so they're rushing to Worthy. Now it's the 3rd quarter. Worthy's going to pretend like he's going to block, and he's going to run the fade, and if you hit it, touchdown. That's what we mean by layering. So Sark might actually purposely not be running an efficient play so he can trick them in the third quarter with a little change. Instead of Worthy lead blocking, he fakes the lead block and goes. So there's things like that, too. They can seem frustrating as a fan, but really there's another layer to the play that he wants to hit later on.
Well said.
All right, cool. Before we keep going, though, guys, let's hear a word from Academy Sports and Outdoors.
All right. Who's ready?
I'm open.
All righty, guys. Let's talk some offensive line. Yeah, we do it all the time. So that Sark will invest early, and you're like, what's going on, to hit a play later. So think like that more than just getting frustrated. Sometimes it's a bad play call. There's nothing that happens. But oftentimes when you're like, that doesn't make sense to me, they're trying to do something to the other coordinator. Okay, let's talk offensive line fairly quickly. We don't need to talk about really depth here. The depth's not strong. We're worried if someone goes down. Eric talked about it yesterday. We have young guys, but everyone's pretty much a year younger than we'd want them to be as a backup. Nick Brooks is a freshman backup left tackle. Connor Stroh, older, but not a very dynamic player speed-wise. Connor Robertson, he could probably start if Cole Hudson didn't exist, so we feel good about that. And if a guard gets hurt, maybe Cole Hudson goes to left guard, right? Robertson steps up at center. You're going to have that interplay. DJ Campbell, we know him. Nate Kibble, about it, we like him, but probably a year too young right now. And then we'll start with Baker here. So Baker, good athlete, former five-star, modern day, moves well if you watch his huddle. But still would probably have liked Cam to come back, even though Cam had big issues. Probably would have liked to give him one more year, but we're going to have to see what's up. So, Paul, what's your take on Brandon Baker?
Yeah, I think he's someone the coaches would like to see step forward. I think he needs to have a big fall camp. I'm a fall camp guy.
I say fall camp. I'm not a training camp guy.
In Texas, it really makes no sense to say fall camp in August. But
yeah.
He needs to really play well. I think pass protection is going to be okay. I think we need to see him be a little meaner and a little stronger at the point of attack in the run game. So a weird irony of this offensive line broadly is that we're going to be a little more physical and better in the run block game at the triangle inside of guard, center, guard. We're going to be a little weaker actually on the exterior at the point of attack with Baker and Goosby. Baker will both be good at getting out on linebackers or on the move. They're going to be good in that regard. What they're not going to be great at is watch for teams that play a big defensive lineman on our tackle straight up, like the old 4-eye that everyone talks about. If someone gets their big defensive lineman and puts them on our tackles and then plays a tight formation and pushes everything in, we're going to have trouble running the ball. Because those guys, I think they're going to struggle a little bit to get pushed. Goosby, because he's 6'7", and he's still young. He hasn't fully grown into his body. And then Baker, just because he's not super strong at the point of a contact. Interestingly, though, if Umiazulu, Hudson, and Campbell all start, that's the guard, center, guard. Some of our stuff on just inside zone or just running downhill ISO, where we ask the tackles to screen, you're going to see some big holes inside. You're going to see these guys move people around in ways that we hadn't seen in a while, because Hayden Connor's real strength was pass protection.
Well, I like him on counter too. I mean, these are athletic pulling guards too.
Yeah, they are. You know?
So it's like, that's what I'm excited to when we run gap, because Campbell and Neto can both pull around and smack guys, and they have speed to match their aggression. And Neto had no problem with aggression in high school. Campbell had no problem. These what I love to see in offensive linemen in high school. I mean, after the whistle, I mean, they would slam someone down. He would try to get back up. They'd slam him down again with a lot of bravado. So they're also mean-spirited, and that's what you want. Interior offensive line, you want them to be mean, and they have that.
Here's the counterpoint. We may take a step back in pass protection inside. So yep. Hayden Connor, one of the best pass-protecting guards in Texas football history. I mean, he was really good pass protector. And that's ultimately why he started, which shows you what the coaches valued the most.
Correct.
Because I pointed out for 3 years, hey, man, this guy's got high pads. He's not getting high push in the run game. But, well, it's not like the coaches don't want – they know that too. And they're saying we value his pass protection more. So there's the element of first do no harm for offensive line play.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is coaches love it when an offensive lineman fires out, drives a guy, and puts him on his back, pancakes him, right? That's awesome. Big plus in your film grade. You know what they don't like? In fact, they hate more than the positive of that play. If you miss a pass protection and you let a guy free run right past you and hit the quarterback.
Yeah, it's a sin. If you let an A-gap or B-gap player in, and quarterbacks will get on you quick for that.
So it doesn't matter how good you are as a run blocker in modern football. No offensive line coach will start you if you allow free runners, period. First, yeah. Do no harm. They would rather have a guy just kind of like screen in the run game, and that's frustrating. But if he's dialed in on pass pro, that's the exchange they'll take in the modern game, not only because of the efficacy of your offense, but also the value of your quarterback, especially for Texas this year. I mean, Quinn Ewers was not as terrible thing to say, but he wasn't as valuable to us last year because we had Arch Manning.
Correct.
We don't have Arch Manning backing up Arch Manning this year.
Yeah, it could be four losses on this season like that.
That's right. So I think that's the aspect we have to approach this with, of like Nato Umiazulu. He's got all the physical skills. He can't space out and like let a guy run past him. Cole Hudson, by the way, very physical guy. He allowed a lot of pressures when he played. He played sort of in that rotation at guard last year. He will allow pressures. It's not because he's blowing assignments. It's more that he's more of a run-oriented guy. So that center guard combo, they've got to be good enough in pass protection. Because Arch, he can evade and extend a play on exterior pressure. So if they bring an extra man off the corner, and we just don't even have a guy to block, Arch can solve that. He can step up in the pocket. He can run around the guy. He can run through his hands, whatever. He can't really solve a 300-pound defensive tackle running up through the A-gap.
Right at his chest.
Yeah.
And even if he can't solve it, the ball's getting swatted. So even if they don't get to it, they're just going to jump up. So that's the big thing. But I think – so he's saying here, but our QB is more mobile, so it won't seem as apparent. So there is some things here, right? Like Arch can withstand, someone hanging on his arm.
Yep.
And that kind of stuff. So we do have – it's not like – I get with Quinn. You had to prize pass protection like crazy because
– it had to be pristine.
It had to be pristine or else Quinn was going to sack himself. And so that's a little different. So I am excited to see that. The difference is, though, Quinn became check down centric. And so Arch is not check down centric. So that means Arch is going to be in the pocket longer as well. So it's also they have more time to get to him. He's faster. He's more athletic and he's stronger. So maybe it balances out, but he will be holding the ball longer too. So that's kind of the trick. And you'll figure out really quick based on their stunts who the defense thinks is the weak link. And sometimes, man, it was Campbell. Like the stunts they were running were to target the guard, not the right tackle. They were trying to pry open that C gap. So to me, this is a big year for Campbell. We know he's a five-star. We know he's talented. This is the year I want to see Campbell put it together because he's gotten picked on sometimes specifically. And it makes sense, right? The left side, you have Banks and Connor, who are great pass protectors. But they would pick on that right side with Campbell and Cam Williams pretty often. Now, what's interesting about Brandon Baker, Nash Talks Texas brought it up, Cam Williams was the second most penalized offensive player in college football last year. So that's a big thing that Brandon Baker, almost statistically cannot achieve that, And so maybe we have a little bit of struggle here and there, but at least hopefully he's not killing us with crucial penalties when it matters. So that could be added value as well.
Most of Cam's were offsides, weren't they?
Yeah, it was all kind of like pre-snap brain penalties, And so that was the tricky part with Cam.
The other thing about Arch, so people think of mobile quarterback means, better ability to avoid sacks. Not necessarily. dual threat quarterbacks actually sack themselves more. That kind of raises an interesting question. Is Arch a dual threat quarterback? Physically, he is, but is he going to be employed that way in the offense? We're going to talk about that in a second. But
yeah,
one thing to know about Arch that is also better is he's not just going to eject around the side when he gets pressure the way like Sam Ehlinger used to.
Yeah, he'll get up.
Arch will step up in the pocket. Yeah. And we haven't really seen a quarterback in a little while who can manage and manipulate the pocket within the pocket. And so, you know, if you ever watch the New Orleans Saints in their prime with Drew Brees is 6 feet tall, like 6 feet even. But he's really strong. He's really smart. He's really heady. Accurate. And what the Saints decided to do was any interior defensive lineman that wanted to sprint upfield, the guards and the center of the Saints would say, fine, we'll carry you up the field. Like, we'll let you sprint up the field, but we're going to be behind you pushing and guiding you. And Drew's job was just to step up right past it. And then he'd have a wide open display in front of him, and he could throw the ball anywhere he wanted. Just understand that there's things that Arch will be able to do in the pocket that will help these guys. But what they can't do is allow free runners ever.
Correct.
As long as they've got their hands and body attached to that rusher, trying to do something to him or blocking off one side, Arch can solve that. You just cannot allow a free dude sprinting up the middle at your quarterback. And that's what these guys really have to demonstrate. And that's what people are going to test, especially Ohio State early in Columbus, because they're going to think we're not going to be able to communicate. Frankly, their defensive line's not going to be great. And they've got great blitzing linebackers. So they are going to test this repeatedly. If we pass the test, it's going to be completions down the field. If we don't, it's going to be, you know, pretty long first quarter in Columbus.
Yeah, I think of the Mississippi State one where Arch just takes the edge pressure by Stone Blanton and delivers the strike. But it shows even Mississippi State was like, all right, let's see what they can do. So, and Arch will, if you notice where he stands in the pocket, he's standing like an NFL quarterback. Once again, picking on Quinn. Quinn is hanging out behind the tackles. Quinn is nervous. He's a nervous quarterback. And so he doesn't believe in being in the pocket. Arch is in the pocket. And if people run by him, like you said with Drew Brees, they'll reset the pocket. And so Arch will step up. Well, also, what's the advantage if they fan out like Drew Brees' example? Well, guess what? Arch now has running lanes. Sark can limit Arch running on run designed run calls.
Yeah.
He can't limit Arch Manning. If Arch Manning sees a first down there, Arch is going to take it, man.
Well, so here's what he's going to do. When we're playing Sam Houston State, he's going to tell Arch before the game, hey, you're throwing the ball today. Your job is not to, you know, if you can run out of, if you could scamper out of bounds for 9 yards, that's fine. I don't care.
Yeah.
But you're not trying to win the game today and like take on dudes on the goal line or any of that. Yeah. And by the way, that's not just a direction that traditional NFL type quarterbacks get. If you go back and look at Vince Young's stats, when we played bad teams, Vince Young did not run the ball. We were preserving him. But then when we needed him, he's getting 15, 18, 20, 22 carries. Yeah. Sam Ehlinger just indiscriminately, we ran him like a battering ram no matter who we were playing, right? Yeah. But you know, there will
be discussions. And that cost Sam. Sam had like 4 injuries at the same time.
Yeah, there will be discussions with Arch of like, hey, you're not running this game.
Well, his granddad tells him before every game. Like he was saying, his granddad's like, don't run. And then he does the UTSA run. Like he can't help himself. Like there's a certain gamerness. And also, I always pay attention when they ask quarterbacks or any player, who's your favorite player? Who's his favorite player? Josh Allen. Wonder why. Yeah. You know, so it's like when that's your favorite. He said Johnny Manziel and Josh Allen are his favorite players. What do those guys do? Did they make plays? And so you got to pay attention to that too. It's going to be interesting for Sark to kind of pull that back. Like you said, this is Sam Houston State. Like, save this for OU, save this for A&M. Before we keep going, guys, Paul has to tell you about Gabe Winslow.
I got to tell you about a guy who's got composure in the pocket, outside the pocket. Free rushers don't bother him at all. He just swats them away. And he's going to get you the best possible mortgage deal. His name is Gabe Winslow. You can reach him at 832-557-1095. Why Gabe? Over 20 years in the industry. He's a UT grad. He's a passionate Longhorn fan, just like we are. and he's really damn good at this. He's a former National Merit Scholar. He's got a law degree. Vastly overqualified to be doing mortgages, and until he realizes that he should be, running a hedge fund, let's take advantage of the fact that this guy does mortgages and does an incredible job. If your idea of getting a mortgage is calling your big bank and getting a quote from the guy who might pick up his phone while working his banker's hours, this ad is not for you. You're already a lost soul. God bless you. Enjoy your horrendous experience. If you're actually someone who's smart and understands incentives and understands what a broker is versus a big bank, this is the guy you want to call. This is the guy you want in your corner. This is the guy you want shopping to 60 different lenders for the best possible deal. 832-557-1095.
All right. Any final things on the run game, or do you want to go to hot takes? We can talk tight end.
I think Arch is going to be a part of this run game. There's no doubt.
Yeah.
When we play OU, when we play Ohio State, when we play A&M, he's going to be a threat to the backside, right? When we're running the ball, mm-hmm. he's going to have the constraint of, hey, I might keep this and take off scampering around the edge. So if your backside defensive end just comes crashing down, if your backside linebackers are taking off sprinting at the snap of the ball, heading over to where they think the ball's going, I can punish that. And I'm not going to punish it with 6 yards. I might punish it with 30. So that's going to be a powerful aspect of our run game. It's going to be very helpful for us. So I wouldn't underestimate that.
Well, schematically too, right? Generally in these reads, if you don't have a mobile quarterback, you have to find someone to block that backside unless your running back's just really fast. Well, now Arch can read the backside.
Yeah.
So that end goes unblocked. You know, if he goes after the running back, Arch can pull it type of thing. And then you can do it with your counter, GT counters, all of that have read options. So you're also helping schematically as well, because you're not having to deal with a backside defensive end. So that's an important aspect too. So it also helps schematically. We're not going to see it, like Paul said, versus Sam Houston State, but designed runs with Arch are also going to be a big factor. And you're going to have to watch that, man. If I'm scouting Texas, anytime they're, you know, within the 10-yard line, I'm looking for Arch to pull it.
Yeah.
And Sark would even do it with Quinn, who's not a runner. So Sark will do it in that situation. Hopefully that helps our red zone. Cause when we're saying our run game, what do we really mean? We mean against Georgia, the top tier talent where we didn't scale, but also most importantly, scoring in the red zone. So if our interior offensive line can move people in the red zone, that's going to help our red zone numbers. And I'm telling you, we're one of the worst red zone teams. If Sark has a top 30 red zone team, we legit might have won the national championship for 2 years. Maybe not against Michigan, but that's the difference in winning it all and not. And that's going to be a major factor when you're bottom 100 in red zone stuff and everything else is on fire. So that's a big thing. Also, Arch can pull it in the red zone. That has a lot of value. And now we also have generally bigger receivers that can help you in the red zone. So to me, I want to know how all of this benefits in condensed space. And right now, it looks like it should be better for us when it's time to score.
Hey, let's punt on the tight ends for future, because I know we want to get into some of this. We're at the 53-minute mark. So
yeah. So all we have to say about the tight ends is, like, we're going to need you to block. That's the trick. Split zone, counter, you're going to have to pull. We need those guys blocking. Ideally, more than just getting in front of people, really blocking. All right, Paul, I got some hot takes for you.
All right, let's have some hot takes.
So this is the first one I got for us. This is Jordan Rogers, ESPN analyst, former Vanderbilt quarterback. And so this is all in response. Paul Feinbaum says he thinks Arch is going to be the best quarterback, blah, 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 a month ago. Everybody has to give their opinions now. Paul's brilliant. Paul guarantees he has to return to the show because he's going to say something wild. Someone's going to counter him, and they're going to have to be like, Paul, we need you back to counter the counter. Feinbaum, the evil genius. Rogers responds with this. This is the quote. I love Arch, Rogers said. I have him as the fifth best quarterback in the SEC. I think everybody got on the hype train because what we saw in limited action. I think we just need to put that in perspective. It was against UTSA, ULM, and the worst defense in the SEC last year, Mississippi State. He says something about those are all bottom 100 scoring defenses. Fair enough. What you have to pay attention to, he's a quarterback, he knows this. Pay attention to the ball placement. That was always awesome. That scales. Pay attention to the pocket presence. Pressure is pressure. That kind of stuff matters. So you can understand that it was against weaker competition, but you can also get projection from weaker competition. But I don't have a problem with this point if you're kind of just going with a basic analysis and not thinking too hard. This is where I think he's getting silly. I think the best thing about Arch, I think he's got a really high floor. He's talking about like a 3-star. I think you know what you're going to get. You're not going to get a bad version of Arch. I just wonder if he has the upside. He does have the upside. He might be the first overall pick. The arm talent, he has the arm talent. Not the strongest arm, but the arm talent. And the creativity some other guys like Sellers, Lagway, and Nussmeier have. That's why I have him ranked here. I still like him a lot. Here's my thing. SEC quarterbacks are really good this year. We have a lot of top quarterbacks, and he named them, right? Sellers, Nussmeier, Lagway, Arch. If you're going to rank them, those guys have more reps than Arch, sure. My issue is just saying that he doesn't know if he has the upside, which is an insane thing to say because first pick overall is the uppiest upside possible.
Yeah.
Arm talent. He has arm talent. Watch him throw that slot fade. Watch him go out sideways. That's all there. And he has great creativity. If you watch him in Mississippi State, he's working to his read, taking pressure and getting there. His creativity is evident in some of his long runs. But yeah, he's not going to be the runner of Sellers. No one is. Deep ball thrower of Lagway, probably not. He's the best deep ball thrower. And then Nussmeier is probably the top quarterback. But it was just kind of – there's other ways to dismiss Arch. This is not the logic line to try to dismiss Arch.
Yeah, I don't really know what he said. Like, it doesn't – it's just babble.
He's just throwing out football words.
It's just incoherent. Like, there's no central argument. He's got a really high floor. But you'll never see a bad version of Arch. But I wonder if he has the upside. It's like, well, his upside is that's what the sell is on Arch. So what you did was actually discount the possible objection to Arch, which is he could be this really creative and athletic quarterback who's a little wild and throws a bunch of picks, right?
Yeah.
That would be the criticism of Arch. He's saying, no, he's got a high floor.
He's very stable.
I think, I don't know if he has the athleticism and the creativity. And it's like, that's kind of that's what defines what makes Arch kind of interesting.
Correct.
Is he's very athletic and he's very creative and he's kind of fearless. So he's just saying platitudes. One thing you realize very quickly is there's a number of guys in the media who actually spend time looking at stuff and will try to have the correct opinion, or at least the opinion they can defend.
McShay, Orlovsky, they do great stuff.
There's a larger number of people who they show up to work at 8:29. They go live at 8:30, and they're just going to say stuff because they're trying to get through their segment.
Well, and like you said, this is now picked up nationally, right? Now you're on ESPN. If you want to get camera time, this is what you say. You either go to the extreme of Paul Feinbaum or you counter in the extreme of Paul. If you have a reason to take down the middle, guess what? You're not getting on today's show.
Well, then if Arch has a big game, a great first half of the season, they'll bring him back on. Well, Arch has done well. Yeah, well, I told you, Arch isn't capable of a bad game. He's got great floor. He's got a great supporting cast. He's got Steve Sarkisian calling plays. You know, it's hard for a quarterback like Arch to mess that up.
Yeah.
That's how he'll justify it, right?
Yeah.
And it's just, I don't know, it's just you realize that there's so many people that are just kind of going through the motions in the media.
Well, to say Arch has no creativity, there's one where he's literally stepping up in the pocket, gets through all his read, and jumps up in the air and throws it to the flat. Like, there's incredible creativity.
Touchdown to Silas Bolden.
I was going to say, there's the one where he's running to it and then pitches it out. Like, there to say that there's no creativity there, you're not watching. And it shows his mindset, right? Oh, yeah, he had a great game, but against who he's playing, I mean, AKA, I don't have to analyze because I looked at their rank. So it's that thing, too, where it's like it's just a lazy way of going about it. You have to be able to project those games to be an analyst.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, if Arch threw a screen against Mississippi State and the wide receiver went for 80 and everyone goes, oh, Arch Manning.
Right,
and
that means nothing. I'm
rolling my eyes at the home going like, great job, you know, DeAndre. But that's not what happened. Like, you have to be able to actually look at the traits. And fundamentally, I don't see it. Also, really high floor. If your floor is really, really high, you're an NFL quarterback. That's what right. you just described, right? Like,
yeah.
part of what makes Patrick Mahomes great is it's not his creativity and throwing it sidearm and all that. It's actually his floor is incredible. Like,
it's the game
every week, his floor is near his ceiling.
And that's what a scout's looking for.
Yes. They,
you know, the most controversial play, you're going to see it, right? So he ranks Mateer above Arch. Hey, man, that's all about what you like. I watch Mateer as a college football. If I evaluate Mateer as a college football quarterback, damn, he's fun. He can get away with a ton of what he's doing in college. It's going to be real tricky in the NFL because his feet are bad. He throws sidearm. He makes himself inaccurate, that stuff. So let's evaluate on that end. But he likes Mateer. He thinks Mateer is better than Arch. So that's talking about a low floor player, high ceiling, low floor
yeah,
player. So his consistency is not even consistent in his rankings. He uses different logic lines depending on who he likes.
Well, and Mateer played a Mountain West schedule.
Yeah, he played a G5 schedule in a
Power 5 coach. Like, let's be clear. UTSA went to a bowl game last year as a G5 team. Most of Mateer's opponents didn't go to bowl games at the G5 level. Mississippi State on a neutral field is going to thrash San Diego State.
Right.
Like that's Wyoming last year went 3-9 and they held that Washington State offense to under 20 points and won the game. So like, I don't know. It's just a guy talking in front of a microphone and,
well, it's what you're willing to throw away and what you aren't. So he likes Lagway. Lagway is a huge time completer of the football. He was young, but he averaged like 55% versus the SEC, and he was really inaccurate. So you don't have a problem with that. He likes that style of play is what I'm saying. High highs, low lows. Mm-hmm. He had high interception to ratio. And the same with Mateer, high, low lows. So he's just exciting player guy, and you can see it here. He's saying because Arch is not doing crazy thing, and also Arch was doing crazy thing, but his argument basically is like, this guy's not wild enough for me. He's got a high floor. He's consistent, but he's not exciting like Mateer and not exciting like Lagway. It's like, well, what's the flip side of your excitement? They're throwing picks and they're inaccurate, you know? So it's that thing too. So that was just a fun hot take. We got another one coming up for you though, Paul.
We got a super chat.
We will hit it. All right, let me get this one pulled up. So this is something that people have been joking about, but we shouldn't take this lightly. We'll hit the super chat first, though.
All right.
Who will be the top SEC quarterback by season's end? He also liked Lenora Sellers, by the way, which also high, low, lows. There's a style of quarterback he likes. So that's what he's paying attention to. All right, who will be the top? Yeah, who will be the top guy, man? Probably Nussmeier. Because Arch isn't coming out this year.
If you win a lottery ticket, I'm going Lagway. He's healthy.
I think Sellers is the lottery ticket.
You think so?
Yeah.
Does he have any receivers?
Just because he has like undeniable excitement to his game. They're going to love the athleticism. I think the lottery ticket for me would be Sellers. I think Lagway is going to improve. Lagway wasn't quarterbacking that much last year. He was throwing deep balls, and it was sick. But if you looked at his completion ratio in the intermediate and in the short, he didn't have full command of his offense. And then I was watching the film guy a couple days ago break down Lagway.
Yeah.
So Lagway has a couple of concepts. I don't remember if it was a drive concept or what it was. But anyways, all of his routes are moving left across the field. He rolls out right. So he's not even running to the that's just a misunderstanding of the offense. That's a young guy stuff. So you want just little things. If you're grading them as an NFL quarterback, he's not there yet. So he just needs to grow, and they run big boy concepts. Like all of their deep in their digs are like minimum 15 yards. Like all of their stuff is NFL depth. And that's great. Cause Lagway can throw it. But that's a tough offense that you really have to understand. I've always liked Napier's stuff. But Lagway's not there as far as command and full understanding. He's going to wow you, but as a field general, that's where Lagway has to take this step this year. We know he's going to be able to be sick in the deep passing game.
Yeah, best quarterback at the end of the year, I think it'll be our guy, actually. And then the retort for Lagway, he was 6-1 as a starter. Mm-hmm. And he played most of that time with a grade 2 hamstring strain. He couldn't mm-hmm. run. So what people forget, DJ Lagway weighs 245 pounds and he can run. And he's not Lenora Sellers as a runner, but right. he's in the ballpark. He runs about like Arch, but he's 245. That's going to be an aspect of his game that you're going to see when they play Georgia, when they play Miami. So I think guys can grow. I think Lagway can grow. Mm-hmm. And but ultimately at the end of it, I kind of like Arch. I like our guy. I think Nussmeier can throw the ball, and he's certainly pretty fearless. But LSU is, man, if you can defend the pass, you can make them pretty one-dimensional very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. So top, I'm trying to, when you say top, I generally just go to like NFL draft boards, but Lagway's not going out on the board either. So I just kind of think Nussmeier is like a 1-1 quarterback.
I don't think he is.
And I hear the downsides people say to me, I'm not surprised by any of these guys being top. I know it's a cop out, but I would say Nussmeier. And then Arch can do it because Arch has the scheme with him. Hopefully as the wide receivers, he has the running ability to confuse defenses. Arch will throw deep. That matters in your yard per attempt. That matters in your wow factor. He has pocket mobility.
Is Diego Pavia one of the best 5 or 6 quarterbacks in the SEC?
So, well, that's tricky, right? Because I just used a system to up Arch. And so if I turn around on my next logic line, like our boy over here, I can't be like, well, he's a system quarterback, you know? Look, if college evaluation, I like Lenora Sellers. I like Pavia. I like Mateer. NFL brain, I like Lagway, Nussmeier, and Arch, you know? So it's like, what are we grading on, you know?
College efficacy. We're going to play.
Pavia is absolutely a top quarterback.
Yeah. Texas is playing a college schedule, right?
Yeah. But I like to evaluate.
Okay.
In the NFL.
All right.
That's how I prefer it. But yeah, it can go either way. That's why when people start ranking the SEC quarterbacks, that's why it's a fun argument. We have a lot of cool SEC quarterbacks.
And between the SEC and the Big 12, really, Big 12's got some amazing quarterback depth too.
All right, final hot take. It's not really a hot take. It's a hot rumor.
All right, let's do it.
There's rumors.
No, he's back.
This man might return. NIL's
not so bad after all.
Everyone's joking about it now until it happens. We need to quit laughing. We need to not let that happen. So I don't know what he looks like in the NIL era, right? We kind of saw what that did to him towards the end and frustrated him and basically took away his ability to warehouse the nation's best players. So that's a different world. But my question is, if Saban comes back, where's the job?
Kennesaw State.
I was going to say Kennesaw State, West Virginia.
He's not going to go somewhere as like a hobby job.
Well, see, that's what I was wondering. To me, I almost would. You know, if I'm Saban, like, I'd be like, dude, give me like a sick G5. Give me North Dakota State. Like, let's get some W's, you know? And not even kind of – that's the big thing is where would you come? And then also they're talking about Beamer for OU, right? So Saban to South Carolina, dude?
That'd be crazy. I think ego would be difficult for him to go back to take Michigan State, right? Hmm. Like, I think he's felt what it is to be at Alabama and playing for stakes and having the sense that you're going to win the national title and not lose games. I don't think he wants to go 7-5 with a bunch of scrappy guys. So, yeah.
I don't think he's going to go 7-5. That's where I was like, dude, he could go to the G5 and dominate. You know what I'm talking? Like, he could go.
Why wouldn't teams just take his best players?
Because you can't do that to him.
That's
really mean, dude.
Okay.
That's a mean thing to do.
All right.
But if, like, look, if you're – maybe he does it, he has a little Dion magic, right? Like, you know I'm going to develop you here. You know you're going to –
he's susceptible to exactly the same forces that every other G5 team is dealing with.
I don't know, man. He's I feel like he's gotten pretty creative in player retention – in the past through unique ways of paying players.
All right, so what G5 academic school has, like, potentially really rich alumni that will just give him money.
Yeah.
For NIL.
Well, he's got to be in the South too, because that's kind of his business connections, right? Like he has all those Mercedes dealerships and like, you know, like his financial network is littered throughout the South, which is beneficial sometimes in your NIL. So it's like someone in the South, Tulane, dude.
Does UCF have like a really rich grad?
I don't know if they're really rich, but there's a billion of them.
Yeah, there's a bunch.
Yeah.
All right.
So, but
he wants to be near his $30 million beach house, right?
Yeah. Well, it's because the thing is, he's saying he's got basically the itch. You could scratch the itch with just going to a good lower ranked team. I know it likely won't happen, but that's my thought, man. If you're doing it for the love of the game, man, do it for the love of the game.
Yeah.
But I don't really know who in the SEC you would be able to take, right? Like if Napier falls off, maybe Florida. Brian Kelly's going to be fine at LSU. He's winning enough to not get fired ever. I really don't know who you would take as an SEC team right now, unless it's like Beamer goes to OU, South Carolina's open, maybe. Like there's not a lot of like clear options or fits. So that's tricky.
Yeah. And also, this could all just be made up.
Back to LSU if Brian Kelly doesn't make it. Yeah, but Brian Kelly's in that awkward spot where he's not fired. He's winning enough, you know? So it's
hard
like,
to fire coaches who go 9-3.
Exactly. And so it's like you might not get where you want, but you're winning enough and you're, you know, producing Heisman and top quarterbacks. So that's kind of the tricky part. But, man, I hope that doesn't occur at all. At all.
What is he going to go to OU, Connor?
That would be disgusting. What a disgusting. Don't even talk like that, dude.
He'd be the worst person in the world if he did that.
Dude, yeah. He would just, I wouldn't even be able to handle it. Quick, this is just Phil Steele, your boy Phil Steele's toughest schedules. We're just going to talk SEC teams. Number two, Mississippi State.
They do have a tough schedule.
Yeah. I was watching their spring camp documentary they put out. It was nice to see Brennan Thompson as a leader in the room, apparently talking about the culture that he's been in for 45 minutes. Well, you know, let me tell you about Mississippi State football. It's like, oh, yeah, tell me about
Mississippi State sent Brennan Thompson to SEC Media Days, and he's been there for 6 months.
Yeah, exactly. He's like telling you all.
This is his third school.
Yeah, he's just like, let me tell you about what Mississippi State's about, dude. So
they let my mom tweet anything she wants.
Arkansas, number three. This is correct.
South Carolina gets hard down the backstretch. Their start of their season, they're going to be 5-1. So, just it gets harder down the stretch. Syracuse, they don't have one of the hardest schedules. They play in the ACC, so this is stupid, Phil. But the big thing is the contrast. So last year they had a favorable schedule. This year they have an unfavorable schedule. So, but they're not in the top. They're not in the top 20. They play in the ACC more often.
Yeah. LSU?
I don't think that's true. No. I mean, they play in the SEC. They play some good teams, but they don't have a particularly brutal schedule at all. In fact, one of the arguments for them on, like, if you read odds makers on the over, is they have a bunch of very winnable games. Like, no, this is bad. God, Phil Steele has just gone to the crapper.
I think it's probably because they're playing their preseason is going to factor in big playing Clemson, who we think has a shot at the title.
Yes. So Clemson is a big deal, but that's they're like Texas and they have this big opening game, but their other three non-cons are a joke. Yeah. OU is correct. OU has a tough schedule. UCLA is a tough schedule. You know what's missing from this top eight?
Who?
Wisconsin. Y'all go look up Wisconsin.
Wait, let me see if I might have skipped Wisconsin. No, yeah, number one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I just went by it really quick.
Okay.
But Paul knows what he's talking about. He called it.
See? Look at that. LSU, like Oklahoma. Researches football. Kentucky. Yeah, Kentucky's got a tough schedule. Stanford does not have the number. God bless. They play in the ACC, nitwit.
All right. So then we got Florida at 12.
Florida should be higher.
That's like the whole pitch on Florida is like they're Texas good, but they're playing. Texas should actually
be higher from a ceiling standpoint, and here's why: we're preseason underdogs in two games, and we're considered to be the number one team,
which is crazy.
So, if you're considered a road underdog in two games before the season even starts, you have a top 10 schedule from a ceiling standpoint, meaning right. Texas has a good schedule if you want to go 8-4. Like, we've got seven guaranteed wins on the schedule probably. But, yeah, we're going at Florida because I think Florida is going to be really good. I'm high on them. If you go at Florida, at Georgia, at Ohio State, there's no other team that has those three ats.
That's playing at the top of the league.
No. So that's
the reason we have seven guaranteed wins is because we're very good.
That's
you know, like they don't factor that in. They're like, you know, they're always like, well, the Mississippi State has a really hard schedule. Yes, they do who they're playing, but also they suck. So it makes it even harder of their schedule. You get what I'm saying? So it's,
you can't do that. You can't do schedule strength by how if the team sucks, right? Because right. then you're like, well, UTEP plays one of the toughest
schedules. Exactly. Yeah. It's like, yeah, they're going to lose 10 games. Then technically they have one of the hardest schedules.
That's right. So you have to look at the opponent's strength. And so some of those Purdue actually should be higher. They have a really tough schedule. But if honestly, the truth is, Connor, unless you're Missouri, who has this amazing SEC schedule that's like a dream, if you don't play in the SEC or the Big Ten and you didn't draw the hard part of the slate, you don't – like he's intermixing ACC and Big 12 teams here, and it's just – it's not correct.
Then you have A&M and Texas right behind them. Like I said, Paul said, at the top of our schedule, we're playing the best teams.
It doesn't get harder than the top of our
schedule. Well, the reason why, like we said, the rest of the schedule doesn't look as daunting is because Texas is really good. If Texas was a 7-5 team, this schedule would look a lot scarier. You got to factor in how good we are. So, of course, teams are going to look like they don't have a chance against us because we're good.
You'll see people do that all the time. Like they'll be like, wow, Colorado, they don't have any guaranteed wins on the schedule. This is brutal. And it's like, because they're not that good.
Exactly. And here's the funny thing. Remember last year it was like Texas has the weakest schedule, which I didn't disagree with. But it's like even the weakest schedule in the SEC is still top 20 in the country. So it would be like, that would be my favorite part where they'd be like, Texas didn't play anybody. It's like, we played a 20 plus strength of schedule. It was just relative to the SEC.
Yep.
Let's see. Alabama, 21. I expect Alabama to have a great year. I'm a DeBoer guy. I believe in him. I think that defense is going to be cool too. And then of course, Ryan Williams.
Yeah. Alabama. It's funny. Like talking about them as a sleeper. I mean, I guess they're not a sleeper, but
yeah.
That is the team that at the end of the year when the dust clears, don't be shocked if the tiebreakers are Texas, Georgia, Bama.
Yeah.
Like I said, I'm high on Florida, and the downside of a brutal schedule is that you play a brutal schedule. The upside of a brutal schedule is you get a chance to put losses on the other elite teams in the SEC.
Yeah, kick them out of the standings.
So in a weird way, if Florida wins the league – they may be playing like Auburn in the title game. You know what I'm saying?
And it was weird scenarios last year. Like if we didn't beat A&M, it was coming down to all these weird tiebreakers with teams you didn't play, but you played a common
A&M would have played for the SEC title, right?
Correct.
God, that's crazy.
Yeah. And so even though they were tied, we almost had a four-way tie. And it all came down to like if you played or you had a common opponent who you played. So that's the SEC can get very weird very quickly like that. Because of the strength schedules here and not everybody playing everybody and all that. So Alabama, one of the lowest SEC schedules. Vanderbilt, 28, man. Maybe Vanderbilt. You saw Pavia yesterday saying that he came back to win the national championship.
All right.
That irrational confidence is why he's great.
It is. Hey, so Clemson there is key because
at
29, they get this big telegenic national television game at home against LSU. Absolutely, early.
Yeah.
And then they get to cruise through the ACC, and then they play South Carolina at the end of the year.
Yeah.
Which I think South Carolina's taken a step back this year, even though Lenore Sellers will be really entertaining. But Clemson's just, man, it sets up so well for these guys.
Yeah. Yeah. Clemson getting to the championship feels like it could happen very
easily. Hey, Baylor sneakily actually has one of the tougher Big 12 schedules, so this makes no sense at all. So not only do they play a tough Big 12 schedule, their two non-cons are Auburn and SMU. Like, those are two real non-con opponents,
for sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And then they're playing the hardest teams in the Big 12. So for them to be at 30 here makes zero sense in compared to some of the other Big 12 teams that are up above them. That does not make any sense at all.
I'm excited to watch Sawyer Robertson too.
He's really good. I mean,
I remember when he played us year one and everybody year one was like, he's trash. I'm like, that guy has NFL everything. Like, he has the size on. He was just doing dumb stuff because he's young. But I'm like, give that guy a couple of years. He has the NFL traits. I think we're pretty much out of SEC people by this point.
Yeah, we're out of SEC teams.
Oh, no, Georgia, dude.
Oh, no way. Yeah. But that's not right.
We got to see. What's Georgia's schedule? I haven't even
looked. I can tell you. They play Texas. They play Auburn. They play Florida. They play
Alabama. They play Alabama.
Yeah, this is stupid. Phil Steele sucks now. I'm serious.
Yeah. Oh, Tennessee. Yeah, no, I agree. They play Texas. They play Florida. They play Ole Miss, Auburn, Kentucky, Bama, Tennessee.
Look at Tennessee at 47.
Yeah.
Tennessee, they play Georgia. They play Alabama. Like, God. What happened?
I know. Yeah. It's not what it used to be, man. That's for sure.
Man, that's just.
Well, the funny part is whenever you're just a fan, right, and you don't do your own analysis or, you know, you're not hooked into local media, which you need to be. The local media always understands their team better than the national guys every single time. But I remember when I first really got into Texas football, started doing this as a job and all that. That's when you realize you get disillusioned. You're like reading these previews and you're like, this doesn't make any sense. You know, you're like, this is just factually incorrect. And yeah. Meanwhile, when you're just a fan, you're like taking this as gospel, you know?
So in the chat, Blake Bryant does bring up a good point, which is they do get Bama and Texas at home. But the point is they get Bama and Texas.
Yeah.
So people get way into home and away. Like, the quality of the team is the most important thing in assessing schedule strength.
Yeah.
So, you know, Ohio State, it's great they get Texas at home. It's not going to feel great if we come in and do what Georgia did to us in Austin.
Correct. What Texas did to Bama a couple years ago.
Texas did to Bama. So ultimately, the quality of the team matters more than where you play them.
What's the rough handicap in betting? Is it like home's worth what, 2.5 points or something?
So this is actually in dispute, and it's variable depending on some formats. The classic used to be it's worth 3 points.
Yeah.
And then people looked at it and said, actually, and then mostly a lot of this is NFL betting, which home field advantage doesn't quite have as much power unless you're in certain places, right?
Yeah.
So then they're like, no, it's actually 2.5. Like, people analyzed it. And now people agree in college, it's anywhere between 2 to 4, depending. So, for example, Utah, who's on our screen right now, is considered to actually have one of the most distinct home field advantages in college football. Whereas A&M, great home environment. But as you've said many times, Connor, for as amazing as this home field advantage is, it sure doesn't result in a lot of W's for them.
Yeah. And I know technically you can't look at the W's. You have to look against the spread. You know, like what they did there. But it's just, I get so tired of that, like where it's just because it's loud and unique doesn't mean the environment. It's a cool environment. It's like being at the fair. It's awesome. Yes. But unless it's translating to you beating the spread or getting W's, I don't care.
I would say the shoe for Ohio State is one of the better home field advantages in college football.
Yeah. What do you think the real ones are? Penn State?
Utah. Ohio State. Penn State. I haven't examined them from a atmosphere versus actual reality standpoint. Penn State's atmosphere is incredible, right? For the whiteouts and no. A big one is BYU, believe it or not. Hmm.
What a cool setting, too. It's beautiful, man.
BYU and Utah have real home field advantages. Scroll up, if you don't mind. Maybe it'll jar me of some of the ones. Miami has no home field advantage.
Because they don't have home field, really. show up places.
USC famously doesn't have much of a home field advantage.
Dude, you watch the stands on some of those pictures, dude.
Yeah.
It's just if like 40 guys decided that, yeah, why not? I don't have anything to do.
UCLA, almost no home field advantage. Texas has a decent one. Florida has a big one.
Yeah, the swamp is cool.
But again, when Florida sucks, Like, your home field doesn't count for a great deal. It's the quality of the teams.
Stanford, Kentucky.
Stanford, home field advantage. I've been to Stanford football games. There's no home field advantage. LSU at night. And that's tremendous.
Yeah, that's a classic one. I can't wait to play there. Maybe I shouldn't say that, but just as a fan, I can't wait to see LSU.
South Carolina would have a real home field advantage if they can get their teams consistently. You know,
dude, Arkansas, when they played us a couple years ago, that was like the loudest consistent decibel I'd heard in a game. Like, I don't know how they do against everyone else, and they've been a bad team. But when they played Texas that year and beat us, just the roar of the crowd from the first to the fourth quarter was pretty remarkable in that specific instance.
Oh, hey, Ryan Nelson brings up one in the chat. Great one, Wyoming. Hand companion to that, Air Force, right across the road from me here. It's a combination of elevation and also, like, the crowd actually gets into it, the field. Wyoming also has wind. I don't think people realize that. That's a big part of playing there. It's not just that it's cold or whatever. I mean, football players like playing in 40 degrees, like, contrary to popular opinion. That feels great, right? It's the wind. It's like how it whips around in the stadium. Like, the crowd gets really into it. Wyoming has a real home field advantage.
Dude, everyone shouts out Jordan Hare. Like, all the SEC guys, like, I know they're like, hey, man, you're not ready for it, but I'm telling you, you don't want to play at Jordan Hare.
Yeah, and it's also a terrific environment.
Yeah, and Alabama fans are permanently scarred. They're like, weird stuff. They basically think Jordan Hare is haunted. Like, if you're talking to an Alabama fan.
So it's a classic. When they're good, it's scary. But when they suck, Diego Pavia can go in there with New Mexico State and get the crowd real quiet. So
you mentioned wind. Okay, State. Actually, I don't like I hate their field design, dude. You can run right into a concrete wall. And they're right up on you, dude. They're right up on you. And what is the thing? They're not. They're facing east, west, or north, south. It's opposite of normally how a stadium is facing. Yeah. And so that brings these crosswinds. And so you'll see quarterbacks struggle more there because of the stadium placement and how the winds in Oklahoma go. So that's always – so maybe not like home field advantage, but, I mean, they're slapping those paddles. They're right on top of you. At night it would be scary, and then if the wind factor, so maybe it's a unique place to play and has its own unique difficulties. I don't know about as far as like a true home field advantage, but it is not fun to play there as well. I think Texas Tech, not one of those, not a home field advantage, but not fun to play there, especially as Texas. I don't know about other teams, but their fans are pretty nasty. So there's that thing too. All right, Paul, we're going to wrap it today. We got Recruit Watch is living rent-free, clearly says. Tyler Atkinson planning to announce on McAfee's show, so I have to go get prepared in case anything happens there.
Are we going to get him, Connor?
I hope so. Eric put in an RPM yesterday at 60%, but, you know, NIL is a legit factor here. I'm sure Georgia doesn't feel great about us taking their top player for the second year in a row. So we felt good about it last night, man, but man, in the NIL world, it's even sketchier to speak with confidence, man.
If you're going to come in with a big offer, come in late.
Yeah.
Like exactly. 5 minutes before the ceremony.
Yeah. Right? Cause you could give Georgia all night to raise the funds. So I can never be too confident, but we did have an RPM last night. So around 6 or 7 last night, Inside Texas felt good, but man, NIL is scary right now.
Yeah. Hey, fun chat, y'all. Thanks for keeping it lively.
Yeah, you guys did great as usual. All right, everyone. Thank you guys so much. Make sure to join InsideTexas.com, $1 until 8:30. Also, you guys need to buy Paul's book. You saw what he's capable of. So reward all that hard work.
In spite of that, buy the book anyway.
In spite of Paul talking the whole time.
How can they find the book, Connor?
You can find it in the link in the description, and you can get your ebook version there, or you can get your physical copy. So whatever you guys are into, you can do it. Chat, thank you guys. And this was brought to you by Academy Sports and Outdoors. Later, y'all.